Welcome to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's program focuses on civil conflict and the dangers associated with state failure, whether it be in Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, or Iraq. Taking the lead in conflict prevention and conflict resolution is the United States Institute of Peace. Its president, Lancy Lindbergh, sat down recently with me to discuss these and other crises. This program was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs Council audience. And it covered a span of fragile states in Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia. And now to our conversation. I get to introduce an old friend tonight, which is particularly fun for me. Nancy Lindbergh, I've known since several years ago. She headed up an organization called Mercy Corps, which is a very important non-governmental organization and very important at this moment in our history as well. And then moved on to be an assistant administrator at the USAID, where she had really pretty profound impact. And I hope we'll have a little bit of time to talk about your priorities when you were there. And now heads up the U.S. Institute of Peace, which is a Washington-based think tank slash action-oriented organization that's really focused on the prevention of violent conflict, the resolution of violent conflict, and post-conflict reconstruction. So she has an enormously important mission and agenda, and it's an organization that's known for really getting things done. So please join me in welcoming Nancy Lindbergh.
Thank you, Jane.
So, Nancy, as we look at, you are recently back from Iraq and Afghanistan, so we're going to get to that. But just as we look at the region of the MENA region, North Africa, the Gulf, the Middle East, spanning to Iraq, it feels like constant crisis. It feels like a series of very fragile states almost unraveling. So tell us a little bit about, is this a unique moment in history? Is this a more complicated moment in history for someone like you who is working so hard to rebuild societies, strengthen societies, and deal with fragility like this?
That's exactly the right question, and it's a little bit of both really good news and news that means we need to focus even more on those regions. And of course, what's really galvanizing a lot of attention is the movement of so many people into Europe right now. This is an historic time in terms of the number of people who are globally displaced by conflict. 60 million people have been displaced by conflict, which is the highest number globally since World War II. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole new situation in terms of people on the move. Some are refugees, some are economic migrants, but they're coming from exactly, as you said, this arc of fragility that encompasses the Middle East and a number of countries in Africa. Although for the first time, the number of displaced people has shifted from being primarily the bigger numbers in Africa to bigger numbers in the Middle East, mm-hmm. which is a shift. But it's also coming at a time where you have a global humanitarian system that is stretched to the limits with not enough resources. You have four of what are called level three emergencies. And these are designated highest mobilization required emergencies. Mm-hmm. It's like four alarm fires that says, international community, we need to mobilize to ensure that we can really address the severity. And the four include South Sudan, Central Africa Republic, Iraq, and Syria. So it really is both the Middle East and key African countries. Mm-hmm. And to me, it underscores both that we need to rethink somehow we manage, organize, and deliver our humanitarian assistance, and also that even as we wrestle with refugees and the whole issue of resettlement, that we absolutely need to keep our focus on the region from mm-hmm. which all these people are coming, and yeah. that arc of fragility.
So let's talk about Syria for a little bit and the effect. And as you referenced, you've got a lot of Syrians coming into Europe, and that's what's captured the attention of the Western media. But of course, they're the frontline states. There's Lebanon, there's mm-hmm. Jordan, there's Turkey that have been absorbing, well, perhaps not absorbing, but have had extraordinary numbers of Syrians arrive in great concentration. Talk a little bit about the degree to which their infrastructure is stretched, their systems are stretched by this pressure.
Well, and that's exactly what's happening. They are stretched. They have absorbed the bulk of the 4 million Syrian refugees who have left their country since the conflict began. We're now in the fifth year of the Syrian conflict. And the region was already saturated with refugees from Iraq, from Palestine. And you have now in Lebanon, already a fragile, politically tumultuous country, 1 in 4 Lebanese are now a Syrian refugee. 25% of their population is a Syrian refugee. This is unimaginable mm-hmm. To consider that level of influx to the United States. Mm-hmm. But and it's in a region that has epic water shortages. Jordan is one of the most water insecure countries in the world. So the water systems, the sewer, schools, clinics, all of this infrastructure was not built for that level of usage. I was in northern Iraq in the Kurdish areas a few weeks ago, where 1 in 5 is a displaced Iraqi, all the Iraqis who fled ISIS as they came into Iraq. And they have, because of the drop in the oil prices, they only have 40% of their budget. So not only is all of their infrastructure stressed, but they are having significant budgetary issues, and they are fighting a war because the Peshmerga are very... So all of this means that at a time where global humanitarian giving is nowhere near meeting the needs, the appeal for the Syrian crisis is only about 40% filled. And it's about half of the money being asked for the humanitarian response in Iraq. That means that these host communities, many of which are already poor and vulnerable, are very stretched. And mm-hmm. so you have a combustible mixture. Now, I will say we've all been saying that for several years, and remarkably, these communities keep managing and keep hanging on. But the question is, can they continue to
right,
do so?
Right. Now, of course, the United Nations has a very large role to play, but UNHCR has been underfunded. There have been a recent set of pledges made. What does the funding situation look like?
Well, it's still quite underfunded. One thing I would say is that there's also, against going back to those other crises, you know, in any other year, what's going on in Iraq in and of itself would be an extraordinary humanitarian situation, and South Sudan and Central Africa and, of course, Syria, and we have them all. Mm-hmm. So it's the funding across that all of the emergencies. And then you've got Yemen, yes. Somalia, DRC. Yes. I mean, it's a long list right now. There needs to be a broader base of countries that provide assistance. It's a very small number of countries, Western Europe, Japan, United States. And the United States has been the largest donor to the Syrian crisis by far. It's, mm-hmm. I think, $4.5 billion since the crisis began. Yeah.
So we've been providing financial assistance and have pledged more, but we haven't taken in many refugees ourselves. In fact, I heard a member of Congress quoted as saying, please, we have our own immigrant problem. Immigration problem is what he meant. Do we have our own immigration problem? And is that even remotely relevant? And should we be accepting more?
You know, we have had a global cap of refugees, meaning any refugees coming from anywhere, of about 70,000 per year. There was a recent decision to increase that global cap to 85,000. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of activity and advocacy right now to say, please accept 100,000 Syrian refugees. Consider that against the number of refugees that the surrounding region has taken in, where between Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, it's more than 3 million refugees. Mm-hmm. The missing piece in all of this is how vital the refugee intake through the years has been for the United States. I mean, we are a country of immigrants and refugees, and there has been extraordinary economic vitality injected into countries that are aging out. Mm-hmm. And this is an issue in Europe as well. So it's a tricky conversation. It's difficult, but we can take so many more than we are taking right now. Yeah. And we also should continue to keep our focus on the source of the problems, the countries that are so fragile, so weak, so repressive.
Yeah. Was there a time, of course, you focus a lot on prevention, as you say, getting to the source of the problem to begin with. Was there a time, in your view, when a military intervention could have tipped the scales, could have made the Syrian uprising insurgency successful, quick, and you know we would have avoided this kind of humanitarian disaster? Was that moment there and available to us?
You know, this is clearly the source of a lot of focus and thinking hard about what options might there have been. I actually think that, you know, it's important to remember the roots of the crisis, which was college students who got out into the street and demonstrated in the midst of the Arab Spring. And remember that it was a country that was so repressive for so many decades that they actually did not have much depth of civil society. They had very little tradition of people organizing for action, you know, all the networks, all the capacity that we have in this country and so many countries have. And so they didn't have the ability to really carry off a very successful set of street demonstrations. They quickly turned violent. It quickly turned into a bloodbath. And the roots of some of the difficulties, I think, are in that, because there isn't really a coalesced opposition. And that's been some of the difficulty of finding who is your partner in this. I think what I really worry about is the fact that the barrel bombs are continuing. We're up to a death rate of about 300,000 now in Syria. And they've got both the threats coming in and the danger from ISIS, but they've also continued the barrel bombs from the Assad regime. And even if we had been able to do something like a no-fly zone to stop the barrel bombs and provide some additional civilian protection, the entrance of the Russians into that space makes that vastly more complicated.
Right. Of course, the question is always, who governs after in any event? You know, when you're describing Syria as having very little by way of civil society organizations, that was true of Egypt, right? Obviously, the Assad regime was quite different from the Mubarak regime, but still you have had that kind of thin civil society. We kind of romanticized Tahrir Square. We all felt a sense of great sympathy and affinity with the young people who rose up. But then when it came time to govern, there weren't folks in place other than the Muslim Brotherhood, other than the military. What would be, as you look at Syria, in fact, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong about romanticizing that, because this is your expertise and I'm just an observer, but also as you look to the future in Syria, do you see, do you have a sense of who might govern if happily this comes to an end, the violence comes to an end?
Well, I think there are a couple of critical points. One is there is a deep desire to not repeat the mistakes of Iraq, where the technical elites were pushed aside and you were left with having to start over again, as well as great marginalization.
So regular civil servants were pushed aside because of their ethnic background.
Anybody who'd ever been a Ba'athist, a part of the Ba'athist Party, which was part of the previous ruling elite in Iraq, was pushed out. And there, I, 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 I think there's a strong understanding that whenever there is a diplomatic resolution in Syria, you need to have the parts of the government that know how to run basic infrastructure and keep a civil service going. You don't want to run them out of town. I think what we forget also is how long it takes for these kinds of conflicts to be recovered from, that there is a long process of reconciliation, of enabling people to come to terms with terrible things that have happened in their communities and in their countries, and a political process to emerge with greater depth of capacity of political parties and civil society. And so whatever happens after hopefully a diplomatic resolution in Syria will be followed by a long period of probably turmoil. And that's why one of the things that U.S. Institute of Peace is so focused on is getting in and working both from the community level up and from the government level down to begin these processes of reconciliation.
So you're doing that in other places. You're doing that in Iraq. You're doing that in Colombia, which is a success story. So let's just take a moment to compare those two experiences, to describe for the audience and for our listeners what it is that USIP does in those two quite different post-conflict situations.
In Iraq, where I was just recently, I had a chance to meet with a number of the tribal leaders who had been involved in a process that USIP helped support of trying to stop what could have been a cycle of violence and retributive justice. Last June, there was a massacre as ISIL entered a Iraqi military facility just outside the city of Tikrit. Mm-hmm. They killed somewhere between 1,400 and 1,600 Iraqi cadets, 1,400 to 1,600 cadets, most of whom were Shia. As that massacre happened, many of the Sunni families who lived in the area fled because they were trying to escape from Daesh. So then some months later, when Daesh was cleared out, the big issue was how to reconcile the Shia tribes who had lost a family member mm-hmm. with the Sunni tribes, some of whom were accused of being complicit in the killings. And this had the possibility of turning into a rolling cycle of tribal justice where you hold the entire tribe right. accountable for what individuals did. So USIP has worked for a number of years with training and supporting a network of Iraqi facilitators. These facilitators worked first with a small group and then with a larger group of leaders from the key Shia and Sunni tribes to get them to come to an agreement that was really in their they realized was in their best interest to not hold whole tribes accountable, but rather hold individuals accountable. Mm-hmm. And the result was that they signed an agreement. They made public statements that they would seek justice through the government system for those who were accountable, but otherwise they would maintain peace. This was absolutely key, and it stopped what could have been a bloodbath. And more importantly, it led to a process in which they worked with the local government to enable families to come home. Mm-hmm. So an initial 400 families came home. That worked. They were guaranteed security by the Shia militia in that area. And now that process is continuing, and tens of thousands have now returned. So it's in the midst of what looks to be, you know, a big, complicated mess. There are often at the community level, you have these opportunities to create peace, to support local peace builders, and to find ways to move a situation forward that hopefully eventually will at some point connect up with a larger process, mm-hmm. but in the meantime are important for maintaining local pockets.
In the absence of that larger solution.
Exactly.
So, and talk a little bit about Colombia as well.
Well, Colombia, for those who follow Colombia, is hopefully very close to concluding the final details of a peace agreement that will end, you know, a 50-year conflict and bring to a close one of the last terrible conflicts of Latin America. And what we've been able to do through my wonderful colleague Ginny Bouvier is to help that process, which has been underway for a number of years, to be more inclusive. Mm. Because there's a lot of research that shows peace agreements that are more inclusive are more likely to endure and to lead to a sustained peace. And so what has been really helpful about this peace process is that many of the displaced community members, women, minority groups, have been able to come to the table and voice their concerns. And so the historic agreement that was just reached in Havana a few weeks ago was really about one of the critical parts of the peace agreement that has to do with historical memory and justice, and formulated in a way that really met some of the key concerns of all sides. And it's getting those pieces right that give you the greatest possibility of a sustained peace.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at models of this model of transitional justice, is it based on other experiences elsewhere? Are you drawing from experiences in other parts of the world?
Absolutely. And at USIP, we have a number of people who both help design peace processes and transitional justice mechanisms, as well as look at what does the evidence tell us has worked and has not worked. And
right.
The other important part of that, though, is that every place is specific to its context. And so, you have to be very careful to adapt it to whatever the specifics are. But we had Afghanistan President Ghani visit USIP in April, in his first visit to the United States as president, in which he talked a lot about the unique challenges to his country of how to design a peace process that worked in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand there are legitimate grievances on all sides, but how to move that forward without creating either people feeling like they haven't been heard or seen, that they don't have legitimate concerns, but also enabling a process to go forward, mm-hmm. which is a common challenge.
Now, one of the interesting things about Ashraf Ghani is that he has started to look at some regional alliances that are opportunistic. I mean, here's a case where it, too, is threatened by ISIL, which you've referred to as Daesh, which is what it's called in the region. But they face that same threat. Talk a little bit about how he's working with Pakistan and maybe other neighbors on a sort of a joint response to ISIL. And is this, should we be made uncomfortable by opportunistic alliances of which we're not a part? Or, are these good things?
Well, when President Ghani came into office, it was as part of a unity government with CEO Abdullah Abdullah. Mm-hmm. There was, he really made a big effort to reach out to Pakistan to have the kind of conversations that enabled them to put into place the beginnings of a process that brought the Afghan government and the Taliban together. Because the mm-hmm. Pakistanis, of course, have leverage over the Taliban because of their presence inside Pakistan. There was also an interesting role for the Chinese, who have a great interest in not having terrorism continue to flourish in mm-hmm. that region, and especially not to cross into their country. Mm-hmm. So there was a confluence of factors that set up the possibility for that peace process to go forward, for those mm-hmm. peace talks. And a part of it was also, if you remember, last December in Peshawar, the attack by Pakistani militant groups, terrorist groups, on a school that mm-hmm. was primarily the children of military. Mm-hmm. And that was their 9/11. That there were hundreds of children killed. that was a moment at which there was a turning of public sentiment and a turning, I think, even within the military elites in Pakistan that said, you know, we really need to rethink our enabling these groups to operate from our soil. Mm-hmm. And it's shifted how Pakistan has operated. The problem that we now have, however, is, of course, what we saw last week in Kunduz with increased Taliban activity in the northern part of Afghanistan and increased presence of ISIL. Mm-hmm. As Pakistan has flushed groups off their territory, they've come into northern Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of thought that that's a part of what's going on right now. So I still hold out hope that Afghanistan and Pakistan will be able to find a way to resume that peace process, but mm-hmm. it's definitely complicated right mm-hmm. now.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, just given how much you know, both as a former government official and as leader of Mercy Corps and now leading USIP, you know, as you think about a diplomatic process in Iraq and in Syria, let's just start with Syria. What would the goal be? If the Russians could be brought to the table, the U.S. could be brought to the table, is the goal to have a multi-sectarian state? Is the goal partition? Is the goal just, or would the goal simply be, you know, make Syria safe for Syrians? Start with the minimum that's needed. What would be the long-term objective, in your view?
Well, I think the immediate objective is to stop the violence, yeah. Stop the absolute, you know, reckless pummeling of the Syrian people, which is, I mean, it's gut-wrenching what's going on there. Mm-hmm. So stopping the violence and creating the space for a process to emerge in which the Syrian people have an opportunity to create their own future. There's a lot of conversation about can Syria be put back together or not. I think that will be a longer term question, and it's ultimately mm-hmm. up for the Syrians to make that determination. But you can't even begin that dialogue in the case of so much death and displacement and ongoing violence.
Can you imagine a circumstance in which Assad would stay in a transitional role, or am I just thinking way too far out given the circumstances of today?
You know, I think it would ultimately depend on whether there is acceptance by some of the Syrian opposition groups. Mm-hmm. It goes again to this, what we were talking about in terms of transitional justice and how key perpetrators of terrible violence and crimes, how are they able to still be in a position of authority and power with mm-hmm. legitimacy? And I think the assumption is, in the case of Assad, no, there's no way that he could, because there's just no legitimacy there. He's systematically killed his people for certainly over the last 4.5 years, mm-hmm. one could argue even before then.
Mm-hmm. So in Iraq, we're in a different situation, but we still don't have that long term, you know, the sense that it is all settled, and we still do have a feeling that there are, the Kurds would like independence, right? And the Sunnis are not totally trusting of the government. As you look there, you know that Vice President Biden, back when he was a senator, thought that partition would be the only real, the only sustainable outcome in Iraq. What do you think?
You know, I think there's what I was really struck by when I was there is how much everybody is talking about reconciliation. The Kurds, the Shia, the Sunni, people in civil society, people in government, people in the religious communities. And there's so many interlocked processes that have to happen. You know, right now there's a dispute between the Kurds. There's no real leadership in the Sunni community. There's disputes within the Shia. So you have intra-reconciliation, and then you need inter, and then you need government to community. And so it's like a nine-dimensional chess game right now. And I think that the challenge is keeping those pieces moving when and how you can find progress and accompany it with some of the key processes that enable more accountable government. Mm-hmm. I was so struck when I was there by the fact that there are these street protests. Every Friday, street demonstrations in the major cities of Iraq that are primarily conducted by young people, and they're not demanding anything that is sectarian in nature. Mm. They are asking for better government. They're asking for less corruption. They want better services. They are connecting to a vision of a better Iraq, a future that is, you know, a different conception of a nation. And, you know, at a time where there's so much concern about violent extremism and the siren song of this ideology, this is exactly the kind of positive alternative vision that one can take hope from. Mm-hmm. And I met with a number of civil society leaders and journalists and activists who are involved with these protests, and they started organically in Baghdad, then separately in all these other cities, but now they're connected up. They're talking to each other. They're sharing demands. There's a lot of concern that they could, that spoilers will come in and make them violent. But in the meantime, if they can move this forward, there is a depth of civil society because of the U.S. investment over the last 15 years that gives us gives you a sense that they can accomplish things that they couldn't in Syria, mm-hmm. because it was such a thin, under-capacity civil society.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're listening to my conversation with Nancy Lindberg. She's president of the U.S. Institute of Peace. The program was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs Council audience. The Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to watch a video of this or other programs, to register for upcoming events, or to become a Council member. And now back to our conversation.
So talk about those who aren't doing that and help us understand the appeal of Daesh or ISIL. We hear that, well, if people only had jobs, yet professionals are joining. Yeah. You know, if people only had education, people with graduate degrees are joining. Give us a sense of the complexity of, you know, what is the appeal? Does it have staying power, given that so much of what it does runs counter to the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad?
It is very complicated. And one thing that we know is extremism is very rooted in particular contexts. What pulls people or what pushes people towards violent extremism? In Iraq, going back to the Baathists, the party of Hussein that was, they were kicked out of power. I mean, we know that the Sunni Baathists are the leaders of Daesh, are the leaders of ISIL, and they, including Baghdadi, the leader. So when I was in Iraq, everybody noted over and over again, you know, no, there's no real surprise that this rose up, because several years ago, there were repeated street protests and demonstrations by Sunnis that were ignored because the Maliki government was so exclusionary. They just only took care of their own, which is the classic move of a fragile state, right? And makes them illegitimate in the eyes of their people. So as we look at, you know, where it started from, it's from inability to have a voice, inability to participate in your government, to have a future in your own country. And it's that kind of marginalization, that grievance, that, you know, it can be related to poverty and to lack of mm-hmm. jobs, but we see that it's also very related to that sense of grievance and injustice.
Right, and sort of lack of dignity also.
Lack of dignity. And then, you know, as you start recruiting outward, there's all kinds of ways that you can appeal to different people.
Yeah. So actually, there's a lot of people argue that states fail because there's sectarian differences within, because the groups can't get along. And there are others that would say, well, it's the other way around. It's the other way around. When a state fails and you're sort of competing for resources, that's when you start allying with your own, you know, and sort of naturally you're sticking with your own as you struggle for that in that setting. Which is true, or is it something, or is it both?
Well, I think it's a combination, and it goes to what is really at the heart of U.S. Institute of Peace's fundamental mission, and that is conflict will happen. Conflict is inevitable. It happens in this country all the time. The issue is, how do you manage the conflict, and how do you help that conflict become transformative instead of violent? Because it's when you go, when conflict becomes violent is when all the bad things happen. I mean, you lose development gains, you atrocity happens, killing occurs. And so what we see when you get to these issues of sectarianism is usually it's whipped up for political purposes, mm-hmm. usually for a winner-takes-all political vision, where I'm going to take care of mine. And and what we also know is that countries go in and out of conflict. And so often it's the power gets passed back and forth. Okay, now I'm in power, you're not. I get the spoils, you don't. And then you switch. And mm-hmm. countries just go through the spin cycle of conflict until you can lift them out of that. And I do think that there are some examples, and there are some ways to be hopeful about how one can move out of those mm-hmm. cycles. Mm-hmm.
So we have question cards that ask about, in fact, we talked a little bit about dignity in the context of the appeal of Daesh or ISIL. This questioner asks, how refugees, particularly the Syrians, how can they maintain dignity in a situation like this as they go into Europe? There are Greek citizens out there rescuing the drowning, but at the same time, you've got the Hungarian government putting up a fence. You've got a lot of tens of thousands of people basically in a no man's land, not welcomed. What is the effect on their psyche? How can they maintain some level of dignity? And how will it make it think about their own role as either Europeans or if they're back home?
That is a really important question, because it goes to the heart of how we respond to people who are displaced and people who are refugees. When I was in northern Iraq, I was talking to a civil society activist who said, we have 7 refugee camps in Erbil, a city in northern Iraq. Said, that means we have 7 time bombs. Mm-hmm. Why? Because most of the children are not in school. Many of the people are dealing with deep, deep trauma. Most of them can't find work. And one of the realities of host countries is that many of them have official policies that prohibit people from working as a refugee. Mm-hmm. And so deprived of work often means you are utterly deprived of dignity. And that there's a clear correlation to a rise of domestic violence that occurs. Mm-hmm. Among refugee populations. Often the only way they can make a living is their kids. If there is school, they have to pull them out. One of the issues that I'm really struck by is there are, I think the figure is in the neighborhood of 12 million children in the Middle East who are displaced and out of school. And the likelihood of refugee children actually getting to school is very low. It's somewhere in the 50% range. This is huge. Mm-hmm. This is huge that you have so many children in that region, out of school, feeling hopeless, no future to fasten to. This is a cauldron. This is a recruiting opportunity of great mm-hmm. potential. Mm-hmm. And so I think at our peril, don't look more closely at the kind of assistance that really focuses on how to help kids get back into school, how to help people make a living, how to provide assistance that is fundamentally about enabling people to maintain their dignity. And one final thing, because I'm really taken about this, the research on what is the impact on children under five on their brain development mm-hmm. when they are in toxic environments with stress, with conflict, with social exclusion. And it's almost as potent as the deprivation from malnutrition yep. and micronutrients. So you have a generation growing up now in that part of the world. And, you know, you want to talk to the leaders and say, do you know that you're depriving your country of a future? Mm-hmm. Not to mention, you know, the 50 years of development gains that Syria has lost, but the future gains yeah. that it is mortgaging.
Yeah. And I actually will want to turn to how your experience in government helped inform you, or how the priorities that you walked into government with helped inform this process. But let me just say, when we think about the education of kids, and we think about within refugee camps, right? We're thinking about the children being able to go to school within the refugee camps and about others who've been somehow denied that kind of basic education. But what about sort of a reminder that university students had their studies interrupted, and these are the folks who would be managers, would be entrepreneurs, would be government
Absolutely,
officials
yep.
right, in a Syria without war. How does one absorb them into universities in Europe and here? And how does one help sort of build that capacity, maintain that capacity to go back and rebuild a society like that?
You're absolutely right, because in fact, I met a young woman who had been actually sitting for her university exams, her entrance exams, when Daesh swept through her neighborhood in Mosul in Iraq. She and her family fled. This was almost a year and a half ago, and since then, she's in an apartment with three families. Mm-hmm. Their savings are being depleted. She hasn't been back to school since then, and she's just looking at her future evaporating, and there's just no clear sense of what the next steps are. And, you know, it's in that backdrop that I think about, you know, what would you do? Would you try to get to Europe? You know, would you take that dangerous journey, or would you stay and with hopes that your country will turn around? I think we need to look at bold solutions and ways in which one can help that generation, you know, all anybody under 25, mm-hmm. Recapture some sense of hope and dreams for a future life. And it's we really have to, and it's not just going to be taking them to other countries, mm-hmm. because a lot of people don't want to leave. I talked with a number of Christians, many of whom are displaced in northern Iraq, and they're saying, you know, if we go to Europe, we lose our identity. These are communities that have been in place since biblical times, and it fundamentally changes Iraq and the mosaic that has been there since, you know, for millennia. Yeah. To your point of you know, how do people think about their future?
Mm-hmm. The next questioner asks about reconstruction in the context, it's sort of asking about division of labor. So this questioner asks whether this is reconstruction after violent conflict, after war, and what is the role for the military in that? And the questioner notes that often a big piece is left to the military, meaning our military, not the local, and what is the role for others? I raise this in part, both because we have this great question, but also because I know that throughout your career, you have thought about three different strands: the strand of defense, the role of the military; the strand of diplomacy, the role of that we associate with the State Department; the strand of development, which you've devoted your career to. So talk a bit about the division of labor when it comes to reconstruction.
Well, first of all, I think a lot of... I think when we work within the international system, we can leverage our contributions far more effectively. And sometimes the World Bank is in the best position to really take the lead on reconstruction. It mm-hmm. clearly depends on the situation. Where the military is essential is on helping to provide security, as well as helping to train security forces. Because essential in any post-conflict environment is people having a sense of security, that they can go home, they won't be killed, they can be in their homes with a future. I mean, just from think about going home after you've been pushed out, you maybe fear your neighbors. For you to have confidence that you can resettle and reinvest, you've got to be secure. That's where the military can be really critical. And then there needs to be, I think, a very important aspect put on reconciliation so that some of that social fabric can be rebuilt, especially when communities have been scattered and violent crimes have been committed. There is a very important role for the military, and I will also say that we are so imbalanced in what we fund as a country. If you think about a $500 billion defense budget, $500 billion, and it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $47 billion for all of our diplomacy and development, all the ways that we engage the world through the civilian, through our civilian capacities, is $47 billion versus $500 billion. It's a mind-boggling difference that I would say we need to learn how to wage peace as well as we wage war, and we need to fund in a way that enables us to do that. And the rebuilding and the reconstruction and all of that has to fundamentally be based on enabling that reconciliation to occur and the peace to happen, or you'll just go back down into conflict again. And I know from 20 years of working in conflict zones that over and over again, schools are built, clinics are built, roads are built, and then one bomb wipes it all out again.
Right. There's also the issue of leverage. There's the issue of how do the various aspects of our government work together when you've got a common goal, like the reconstruction of Iraq, for example. How do you make sure that the world of development, the world of diplomacy, and the world of the military are leveraging one another to achieve the shared outcome? And was this something that you thought about a lot when you were in government?
Yeah, and I think we've gotten better at that, but primarily in the realm of natural disaster, the aftermath of natural disaster, where the military brings an enormous advantage because of their what we call lift capacity.
Yeah.
You know, so
logistics.
Logistics. So when the Philippines hits and you've got, you know, a string of islands and all the roads are out, you know, there is nobody but the U.S. military that can move as fast with the capacity to move essential supplies around. And in the last decade, the humanitarian community and the military have become much better at understanding each other's capabilities and coming up with frameworks that enable that to be a productive and constructive relationship. Mm-hmm. It's really quite, if I think of back to the Indian Ocean tsunami a decade ago and, you know, where we are now after the Haiti earthquake and the Philippines, the Fukushima, Nanapal, it's light years better and different. We need to do that now for the conflict. Mm-hmm. We need to figure out that kind of shared understanding of how to create a framework that enables more effective leveraging.
Right. And you've said that we have to sort of relook at how we approach humanitarian catastrophes like this, right? That we've got to figure out how to make the money get released more easily, everyone be more agile. Are there specific recommendations that I should be asking you about that you are making from your in your role at USIP?
Well, you know, they say never waste a crisis. And I think that the crisis we're having right now will hopefully push us to rethink how we provide assistance and where we focus our attention. We are we have institutions that are very stovepiped, that separate humanitarian efforts often from development efforts. And that is not the experience of the people who are seeking assistance. And instead of just providing fundamental food, water, shelter to refugees, for example, when we know that they will be displaced for an average duration of 17 years. We need to be thinking of how to help them become more resilient and how to build a future for themselves wherever they are. And bring in the development actors and the humanitarians to jointly plan for assistance to the host communities, assistance to the refugees, and bring those closer together instead of sitting in stovepipes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We just got a question card that I thought was particularly important because it's something we really skipped over and shouldn't have, and that is the length of time of the people normally are displaced. We're acting as though, or our conversation would have suggested, I think thus far, that these are short-term crises, right, and that people can get back within a reasonable time frame. I actually don't know what the average amount of time is for someone who's displaced, and I'm sure you do.
17 years.
17 years. And we think about the Palestinians in Jordan that have been three generations or more in refugee camps. So this questioner was asking, what are the chances that people are going to be able to return in their lifetime to Syria, for example? What are they more likely to stay elsewhere and try to form a life elsewhere?
Because we don't know yet. One of the reasons we have such an enormous number of people displaced right now, 60 million, is because there are so many protracted conflicts. And it's not only the duration of the conflict, but you know, if the war ended tomorrow in Syria, the destruction is so complete that it will take a very long time to rebuild cities that are absolutely bombarded into pieces and to rebuild the social fabric. So in my mind, what this underscores is the importance of tackling fragility, rethinking how we work with countries that are fragile. And what we mean by fragile is they can be either weak and ineffective, and they could be also illegitimate in the eyes of their citizens. Mm-hmm. And we know that that arc of fragility is where you have a concentration of poverty, of conflict, of violence. It is from those states that we're seeing the majority of the refugees coming from. It's also where you have violent extremism sources mm-hmm. clustered. This is two fragile states that were just starting to make progress in West Africa, was where the Ebola virus jumped from. So we need to refocus on how we work with those states. And that's where your earlier question is really relevant, because it's a combination of increased security, more legitimate politics, the kind of assistance that really focuses on inclusive politics and mm-hmm. reconciliation. And that takes a common vision of our humanitarian development, diplomacy, and defense efforts.
Yeah. Now, in the case of those three West African countries of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, they'd made great progress post-conflict.
Yes.
But what was missing was a strong health system. Are we working in other countries to do such things as strengthening health systems, particularly throughout Africa?
Well, there's in the wake of the Ebola crisis, Congress passed a very important and generous funding bill that enables a focus on what's called global health security, because it was just painfully evident that if there's a hole in the net anywhere, we're vulnerable, which I think is a good analogy in general. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in a global world, and so it matters if you have a fragile state over there, you have displaced people over there. So there is a big effort underway, and it's both to strengthen health systems, and it's also to enable those health systems to understand viruses and emerging endemics. But I would note that one of the reasons that Ebola became such a problem in West Africa that was specific to these countries being post-conflict was not just the weak health system, it was the lack of trust between communities and the central government. Mm-hmm. So that when the governments started putting out exactly the right kind of messages about how to protect yourself, because at the end of the day, Ebola is a wimpy virus, right? You can protect yourself very easily with good practice. But people didn't believe the messages. They didn't believe what the government was telling them. And so it goes to that that state society confidence and trust that is essential, that is missing in a fragile environment. Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to building, again, to strengthening state capacity, what are the entry points? There's health system strengthening. What about ensuring that states are responsive to their citizens in other ways, that they're when it comes to the delivery of services? What about the problem of corruption? How do these issues come to bear when you're a development person and you're focused on inclusive development in a fragile state?
Well, I think from a development perspective, it's understanding that the development is occurring in a system that is political. Mm-hmm. And that is a shift from investments that are purely about, you know, building economic growth or mm-hmm. working on health. And having the understanding of the politics. I am a huge fan of what happened in New York last week, where we celebrated the success of the 15-year effort with the Millennium Development Goals, right? Where in 15 years, we accomplished cutting hunger in half, cutting poverty in half. These were considered to be unbelievably unachievable goals when this was launched. But in fact, we came together as a global community and did it. And we launched the next generation of sustainable development goals, which include the historic Goal 16.
I was going to ask you about that.
Goal 16, which is, I know this is getting kind of wonky, but this is historic because what it says is we've made the easy wins. We've got all the easy wins on poverty and hunger. Where it's hard is the fact that there's a stubborn clustering of poverty, conflict, and violence in these fragile states. And the only way we're going to make progress in the next 15 years is if we understand the fundamental, central importance of accountable, transparent, inclusive governments with access to justice for all and strong institutions at every level. And that's Goal 16, and it was a hard-fought win because it's very threatening to many countries. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's included gives us something to work with. And it's very aspirational, but it's what will make the difference as we now look at 2030.
I think that's the big question, is having made that commitment, are states ready to carry through on it? I mean, that's a commitment to build accountable institutions throughout governments. Are we ready?
Everybody voted for it. Mm-hmm. It was a hard-won vote. I think it will be a long journey together, but we need to think about it in the backdrop of the many global gains we've made. Change is possible. If you look at, what happened in the development of the whole UN system, what happened with the Marshall Plan, the fact that we have made this progress. I mean, there are positive change is happening if we stop and look backwards. These are the toughest challenges that lie ahead. And I am a firm believer that if we don't lapse into cynicism and if we stay focused mm-hmm. on trying to create these global frameworks from action, that we can move it forward.
It's better to have a bold goal than not. So the last That's question right. card is asking you who will replace Mr. Guterres as head of UN High Commissioner for Refugees. So we're looking for the who. I don't know if anybody in here is a candidate, but
what no do you crystal imagine? Ball. No crystal ball on that. But I will say tomorrow is the announcement of the Nobel Peace Prize, which is something that I'm eagerly awaiting, because we need to celebrate those who are building peace and bearing witness to the importance of those kinds of heroes on the planet.
So, Nancy Lindberger, I want to thank you and ask you all to join me in thanking her for the work she does and for this hour.
Yeah, thank you, Jane.
You've been listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this program was my conversation with Nancy Lindberger. She's president of the U.S. Institute of Peace. The organization focuses on conflict prevention and conflict resolution. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to watch the video of this and other programs, to register for upcoming events, or to become a council member. This program is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.